You are Locked On Cavaliers, your daily podcast on the Cleveland Cavaliers, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Now is Robert Flom at Rich Homie Flom on Twitter. He's the managing editor at Clips Nation and a stats writer at Blazers Edge, two members of the SB Nation family. Robert, how's it going?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. So I think the place that is logical for us to start is with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. He is in the class of interesting young point guards, him and Sexton, I think, will be compared because I think they're, I think a lot of people have Shai, and I think I do too, currently higher than Sexton, but Sexton's had some big games. But without, I don't want to compare them. I just want to know, what has he been as a rookie, and has he like exceeded your expectations or, you know, not met them? Like, what has he been as a rookie so far?
He has definitely exceeded my expectations. I think that when you just look at his box score numbers, they're not super impressive. You know, 10.2 points per game, 2.7 rebounds, 3.1 assists, but the assist number being particularly low. Some Clippers fans actually criticize him for not having enough assists, but the impressive thing about him really has been his defense, I think, more than anything. He's a guy that when people were looking at him in the pre-draft process, they thought he could eventually become a good defender. He's really tall. He's like 6'6". He has huge arms, I think like 6'11 wingspan something. But he's really skinny, and people thought he would kind of get pushed around a little. You know, it would take time for him to learn NBA defense, and it did. But he is already a plus defender at the NBA level. Could be a plus-plus already. He's really good. He works around screens very well. He's excellent at contesting shots. He moves his feet. And he's even been able to deal with guys off ball, which is something that can be very tricky for young players. But he's guarded Klay Thompson a couple times when the Clippers have played the Warriors, defended him really well. I think all defense level player is probably where he's going to end up, at least at that level. Whether he actually makes the teams or not, who knows. But he's already a very good defensive player in the NBA, and I think he could be a great one. So having that as a rookie point guard is pretty impressive. I think the offense has been a little bit more come and go. There have been games where he looks almost unstoppable when his pull-up jumper is falling, and then there are games where he doesn't look quite as confident, and he just kind of pushes his shots, and he shies away from contact around the rim. But when in games where it all comes together, he looks like a future star.
For me, I guess the most impressive thing about him is just how smooth he looks when I see him play. Mm-hmm. He's a guy that for a rookie especially just seems to have such a control of the game, or at least an awareness of what he needs to do with the ball in his hands. Is that something that comes through when you watch him on a game-to-game basis?
Oh, absolutely. It's super impressive, and it's one of the reasons why Doc Rivers made him a starter, 10, 11 games into the season. Just nothing ever really seems to faze him. Again, there are games where he looks less confident, but when he's playing, it doesn't really come off that way. He always is able to get to his spots. He moves so smoothly. It doesn't have tremendous explosion. He doesn't have the burst of like a Russell Westbrook or De'Aaron Fox, but he just glides. It's really fun to watch him just move on the court. And you know, there's always old sayings about people who look like basketball players, and Shai definitely looks like a basketball player. I don't think the Clippers have had a rookie point guard this smooth since as long as I've been covering the team, and really not many rookie point guards I've seen have looked just this comfortable on the basketball court playing big minutes, 26 minutes a game for a playoff team.
So what is this Clippers team? ever since they traded Blake, it seems like, and I mean, they're still going to be trying to be free agency players this year, but they've made deals. They traded away Tobias, traded away Boban. They have Gilgeous-Alexander. You know, they got Landry Shamet now. They Gallo's been pretty good, everything like that. But they're going to be a playoff team. They're going to be the one team in LA that does make the playoffs. So what exactly is this Clippers team? And are you surprised at how quality they've been?
I'm a bit surprised. I think before the season, we had a round table where we predict their standings. And I said 43-39. They're 41-30. They'll probably end up with 46, 47 wins, maybe even more. I mean, they've won seven of their last eight. But really, I think it's so cliche, but a lot of it is mentality. They're super tough. They come to play almost every single night. Off the top of my head, I can only think of two or three games this year where they were blown out and just never really looked in it from the jump. They've worked their way back from multiple 20, even 25-point deficits to win games, not just fake comebacks where they make it look close and then end up losing. They're just a really tough team. I think Pat Beverly probably embodies that more than anybody else, but certainly Montrezl Harrell as well. And the force off the bench that's Lou Williams and Montrezl Harrell has been pretty well documented. It still should be said they're the highest scoring NBA duo, I think, in like recorded memory, at least in like 30 or 40 years. But really, I think the story of the new Clippers has been the starters. It's been Landry Shamet, who came over for the Tobias Harris deal, just an absolute lights out shooter, super impressive. And Ivica Zubats, who has been kind of iffy on the offensive end, though he is dealing with hand issues, but moves his feet really well for such a big guy, showing promise as a rim protector. It's just one of those teams that has 11 or 12 actual NBA players, and some legit NBA guys are not playing right now. Ty Wallace is out of the rotation. I think he's a pretty good NBA player.
So what has been the – is there like a secret sauce or something Doc has done that has made this team work the way it has?
I'm not really sure. I think just the playing of togetherness, which is Doc and Pat Beverly and just a lot of the veterans, but – their offense is really good. I think they're 11th right now. They're just out of like the top eight or so. And a lot of that has to do with Danilo Gallinari, who's having probably the best season of his entire career, age 30, after a very just disappointing, basically non-existent season last year. He played 19 games, was injured, didn't look good or healthy. And this year he's only missed a handful of contests. He's hitting like 45% of his threes on over five attempts a game, getting to the line, playing pretty good defense. He was the Clippers' best player before Tobias Harris was traded. I think most Clippers fans would probably agree that due to his defense, he's probably somewhat better than Tobias, but just doesn't get much of the shine because he doesn't have a flashy game. So I think if there's any secret ingredient to the Clippers' success, it's been Gallinari's play and especially his health, because he's notoriously been a not healthy player in his NBA career.
So for you in this game, this is obviously a Clippers team that is much better than this Cavs team. The first time they've played all year. What are you like actually looking forward to watching in this game? Like, is there anything about this matchup that where you're like, I want to pick this specific thing apart? For me, there's only really one thing, and I think it's kind of obvious, but I want to see what you say.
I mean, the Sexton Shea.
That's it. Where I'm at.
I think Shea has kind of come up to play against some rivals this season. Notably, he's destroyed the Sacramento Kings with De'Aaron Fox, and Fox was the point guard at Kentucky the year before Shea was there. He's played super well against the Blazers. He regards Dame Lillard as kind of a role model, even though their games are completely different. He's played really well against them too. I'm very curious to see how he does against Sexton, who was drafted above him, and also curious to see how Sexton does against Shea, because most people think Shea is a better prospect. So I think both guys will honestly have a chip on their shoulders, and it should be fun. And they're also, they play such different styles of basketball. But in a non-related thing, if Tristan Thompson is playing, I'm not sure if he is or not, he could do a lot of damage against the Clippers. They've had problems with guys who get offensive rebounds all year, and he and Kevin Love, if Love is playing, I'm sorry, I'm not more up to date on the Cavs.
No, I mean, so I'll just say
could do a lot of damage.
Yeah, I'll throw an NPR timestamp in here. It's 10:46 on Tuesday as we record this. I do things ahead of time because I'm not a crazy person who tries to do things like 2 a.m. As we recorded this, the Cavs have listed Kevin Love, Larry Nance Jr., and Tristan Thompson all questionable for Wednesday. Nance and Thompson were listed as out for Monday, but were previously listed as questionable or doubtful in one of their cases for Saturday against Dallas. So like they've been like inching towards being back, and it would sort of surprise me if they don't play on Friday, or at least one of them doesn't play. And like there's certainly going to be a rebounding difference if it's like them playing versus Marquise Chris playing the four or whatever. Like there's going to be a big quality difference there that LA would have to deal with. That's like one thing that at least would be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Sexton Shea is really the only thing that most people care about. But in terms of actually winning the game, I mean, it's a game the Clippers need to win for playoff jockeying. But if Nance and Thompson are playing, I would not be surprised to see it a little closer than people might think. The Clippers have had problems with big offensive rebounding guys all year.
So let's just, we'll wrap up here kind of talking about Shea and Collins. So they are very different, as you have correctly pointed out. Sexton plays very fast. He's on the scoring run right now. I think Shea's a much better defender at this point. I don't know where he is on like the defensive RPM rankings, but like Sexton's like near the bottom of the league. It's like there's a little tier of its own of awfulness, and it's like Trey Young, Jordan Clarkson, and Collin Sexton. And it's like the Cavs just have two of the worst defensive guards in the league, and the tape bears that out as well. For me, what I want to see in this game is it's really on Sexton, because he's a guy that, or the first time he played Trey, he tried to just destroy Trey Young and like prove a point. It didn't really work. He's mm-hmm. playing a little slower now, is playing a little more in control, but he still is like a hyper competitive dude, and he plays really fast. And he also like struggles with the kind of player that I think Shea is, where he's patient, shifty, knows how to run a pick and roll really well. I just want to see how, like, it's weird for me to, like, see how to be putting so much emphasis on, like, guys who are very malleable in terms of their future and whatnot, but, like, I just want to see how Sexton on both ends of the floor, if he, like, can implement himself on offense, and if he can, you know, show some improvement on the defensive side when he inevitably gets screened and has to defend a pick and roll against Shea.
Yeah, Shea has done really well against smaller point guards this year, and Sexton isn't tiny, but he's definitely much smaller than Shea. Shea's basically go-to shot is this little pull-up in the mid-range, and he can elevate really easily over smaller guys. Sexton's going to have a hard time stopping that. I think, like you mentioned, kind of the key will be on the pick and roll, because if he gets caught trailing, Shea's really good already at getting guys on his hip and drawing fouls or just creating room even easier that way, as well as making dish passes to the rolling big man. On offense, Shea does also have a tendency to foul. It's curbed a little bit in recent weeks, but he has gotten in foul trouble a fair amount this season. So Colin Sexton's a pretty aggressive player, and it's possible we see him draw a couple fouls on Shea early in the game. I think he's probably going to be going right at him. So that's something interesting to watch. But I think overall, Shea's kind of has the matchup advantage. He's just bigger and longer, and I think Sexton might come out a little too hot, whereas Shea just kind of never gets rattled. And you know, it could either go really badly for Sexton, where just Shea kind of dominates on both ends quietly, or he could, you know, keep scorching the nets like he has been. It's been shocking how well he's shooting the ball from three. So he could definitely do damage out there. And Shea, by the way, is a -0.72 defensive RPM, which is right in the middle of point guards.
That's incredibly much better than Colin Sexton. That's a flabbergasting difference in terms of that. I mean, that's one defensive rating, and defensive ratings aren't perfect, but like the film says, Sexton's bad on that end too. Just in terms of the pick and roll with Shea, what are like the key or main variations they like to do with him? If someone's gonna watch this game, like who's the guy that like he's got good chemistry with in the pick and roll that people should be aware of for Friday?
I'd say, in terms of pick and roll, I'd say Zubats. You know, he's actually not great at certain passes, but one thing he's already been really good at is doing these little wraparound and bounce passes to big men in the pick and roll. Earlier this season was Marcin Gortat, now it's Zubats. But I think probably the most deadly is he does little pick and pop actions with Gallinari, where if two guys come to him even a little bit, he just flips it back to Gallo, and Gallo's been draining those threes all year from the top of the arc. So probably those two guys. But honestly, Shea doesn't run that much pick and roll. It's something that Clippers fans have been demanding all season, is to watch him with the ball more. But because he plays alongside Pat Beverly, who's another point guard, he often plays off ball a lot, and that's where his improved three-point shot is coming into play too. He's up to 37% for the year, though on pretty limited attempts. So I wouldn't expect that much pick and roll, but if so, probably Zubats, and then maybe some pick and pops with Gallo.
Can I just say that my nightmare of this is that this is like the one thing we care about, and then it's like Brandon Knight's going to guard Shea, and like Colin Sexton's going to guard Beverly, and vice versa. And I'm just going to be like, why? Like, come on, guys, just give me what I need.
I would not be shocked if
me neither.
Sexton at some point, but I think Doc is honestly pretty good about that stuff. It's one of the reasons coaches love him. I think he probably will let Shea get a crack at guarding Sexton, but if Sexton's hot, I mean, Beverly's going to go on him, and I think that would be pretty nightmarish for Sexton, because I think Beverly is the exact kind of guy who can get in his head. And also, I mean, he's just a really good defender.
Yeah, Pat Beverly rules. Him trolling LeBron was just chef's kiss perfect. But you can find Robert Flom on Twitter at Rich Henry Flom. Find his writing at Clips Nation and Blazers Edge. Robert, thank you so much.
Yep, thanks for having me, man.
And joining me for this week's Draft Friday is the host of the Thick Jack Frames podcast, a draft writer at Fear the Sword and The Step Back. It's Trevor Magnotti on Twitter at Illegal Screens. Trevor, how's it going?
It's going good.
I'm going to ask you one thing before we get into our topic this week, which is the 3-4 position as we evaluate it in this draft. When I tweeted the other day and you just kind of owned me about the Nick Stauskas sign for next season, what goes through your head when you see like me and other Cavs people just giving takes? You're just like, guys, what are you doing? Like, what are you spending your time on this for? Like, what's going through your mind when you see these takes, especially my bad ones about Nick Stauskas?
Well, I think the big thing is like we saw this last time too, and it's a huge thing for every team. Every fan of every team does this. It's you get attached to guys who you watch all the time, and you get an inflated sense of who they are. And Cavs fans are doing that a little bit right now with two guys. They're doing it with Stauskas and with David Nwaba.
Well, no, I'm going to add a third one. Marquese Chris has got some fans out there, man. That's a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, he falls into this too, definitely. These are guys who are on cheap deals, and the team usually got for free. And you look at their performance and you start thinking about how the team can improve. And you're like, you know what? I think I'd like to keep this guy around long term. He feels like a building block. And while that makes sense on paper, that player is almost guaranteed, the way that the cap is structured right now, to, if they sign back, to be coming back on a much bigger deal and to be kind of locking you in to that level of player, when that level of player is actually fairly replaceable when you look at the NBA as a whole. And I think that's the big thing that you have to keep in mind, and kind of sets the tone for what we're going to talk about tonight with regards to Nwaba. Is David Nwaba has been great this year. He's done a really good job with the role that he's been asked to play. He's by far the Cavs' best defensive player on most nights outside of Tristan Thompson, it seems, this season. And he just goes out there and does his job. And it's really easy to fall in love with a guy like that. But you see the positives with a guy like him, but you forget that there are also negatives. And you forget that it's fairly easy to improve on that type of player. Even if you can't get someone as cheap as Nwaba will probably end up being, you kind of lock yourself in place if you sign him long term, because that means you've got him taking up a roster spot. You have him kind of, you know, he's got an increased contract, which means you kind of have to demand to play him. And it makes it harder to add talent in the future that could be an upgrade over him. And that's the thing that I think you need to remember with how this next Cavs rebuild is going to go, is you don't want to lock in Alonzo G when you can easily go out and find a player that can give you 150% of what Alonzo G is for not much more money.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I will say, I think like the tightrope you sort of have to walk with this stuff is you need to find guys that like can help you get through a couple years without committing to them too long. I think you have to use it from a team's perspective. I don't love thinking about it this way, because I don't like love the ripping the players out of how we talk about basketball. I find that very odd and like counterproductive. But if you're a team, you want to like leverage that. And if you're like, if we're going to look at like a soccer comparison, if you are going to sign like a guy that is coming out of sort of nowhere and you got for very cheap, like you want it to be like Dele Alli and not like Musa Sissoko. Like you want them to be like a piece that is actually part of your building block and not one that like you completely misscouted and like overvalued, because that can cause problems when you're relying on them to be like a key contributor on your team. If you don't know who those two players are, like, just Moussa Sissoko is like, he's like the Jeff Green. Well, that's probably like a little mean to Jeff Green.
You don't want to pay Evan Turner and Myers when you can find several Evans, Turner, and Myers's Leonard in the NBA today.
Yeah, I'm now going to call Moussa Sissoko French Evan Turner. Like, that's what I'm going to do now. I'm here for that. Okay, so the construction we're going to start with that Trevor has outlined, I think, very eloquently here is guys like David Nwaba in particular, and based on this specific draft class, you can find guys to do what they do. Maybe they're not ready to do it from day one, but in 2-3 years, they could be that player and maybe surpass it. I think there are clear limitations on Nwaba. He's not a shooter, won't ever be, and I think you look at his defensive versatility. I've watched in recent games, like, I do not believe he's the quickest guy laterally in terms of defending ones, and he's like 6'5", and while he's very strong, bigger fours are going to be a problem for him. Now, you look at this draft class and tell me, Trevor, tell me if I'm wrong here, for the Cavs, won't be something that makes sense for them in the lottery, I would guess, but with the Rockets pick, a player like Nwaba, who could potentially be an upgrade over Nwaba in a year or two, and could, you know, come in and maybe contribute some on day one, should be pretty available there later in that first round.
Yeah, this is a particularly good draft for players who are going to take Nwaba's job. There are probably four or five guys in the draft class as a whole that I would take over Nwaba long-term, no question. Up at the top of the draft, you've got DeAndre Hunter, if they end up in maybe the 6 or 7 range. Later in the draft, there's several guys who I think offer more upside than what you're getting with Nwaba. You can get potentially Grant Williams. You can get maybe Brandon Clark, Dean Wade of Kansas State, Sekou Ndomboya, who we talked about last week, from overseas in France. This is a big year for guys who can flip between the 3 and 4 spot, who are intelligent team defenders and offer offensive upside. And it's that offensive upside that really puts most of these guys over the top for Nwaba for me, because as good of a defender as he is still a very limited offensive player, and he is 26 already. I mean, he's not going to get much better at this point. So I think that there is really not much utility to kind of crossing those guys off the list of guys you can potentially draft with that Rockets pick, because you're invested in David Nwaba. Now, you can't have both, but, like, for our intents and purposes, we're trying to say, like, who are you taking long term? Who do you want to be the guy that is playing, you know, the 3-4 spot in most of your lineups consistently in the 2020-2021 season?
What to you in terms of the guys available? No, well, first, am I right? And besides DeAndre Hunter, who wouldn't be in play at like 3 or 4 or 2, but like could be in play if they're like a little bit later in that. Is this, especially if this is later, is this certainly a position of strength with that second first round pick? Is that sort of where that pick becomes a pick, especially if like Coby White isn't available, which seems likely at this point, considering how high I've seen him on some draft boards of late? Like, that slot is going to be a place where the Cavs can kind of pick the archetype of this version of that player that they want. Like, there are different versions of this guy that will be available at that specific pick.
Yeah, definitely. I think that your upper-tier guys, which are going to be Clark and Williams, they'll probably be gone by that point, like 25. I would expect that both of those guys are off the board by then. Maybe not now if we had the draft. That isn't the perception, but I definitely think by the draft that'll be the case. But it definitely, you're still going to have options. You're still going to have PJ Washington. You're still going to have Dean Wade. Ndomboya, maybe. Nasir Little, maybe at this point, which is another conversation. But there's going to be guys who can fill this role at that spot.
All right, let's start with Nasir Little, because I think he was as high, tell me if I'm wrong about this, Trevor, but he was as high as like number two on some boards. Yeah, which is, so it's been a big fall for him. He's had a pretty bad year at North Carolina. You and I have talked about this on the show, I think like 2-3 weeks ago at this point. What has caused his fall, and like, what is the difference in your mind of drafting him, let's say, like, as if a team took him in the lottery versus taking him at like 24, 25?
I mean, if you're taking him at 24, 25, you're almost entirely betting on his athleticism being something that can make him a contributor. I mean, it reframes the conversation in a way that is very advantageous to the player. We saw that with DeAnthony Melton this year. He was a guy who was, for most of draft Twitter, in the top 20 firmly. Because he was an elite defender in his 1 year at USC, had the year off, made some changes to his shot mechanics, and looked like probably the best perimeter defender or defending wing in the class last year. Now, he goes 20 spots lower than anybody else had him, and instantly he goes from, you know, what would have been a good pick for, like, the Milwaukee Bucks at 17 to being an absolute steal for the Rockets and an absolute coup for the Suns to have picked up in the offseason trade. And he's kind of proven that this year. I mean, he's the guy who's picked 47th, who has been a starter caliber player for the Suns. And I mean, that is not a high bar, but it's a high bar when you talk about second round picks in year one, especially. So I think that you're going to kind of see that again with Little if he falls. I mean, there is going to be a certain point where the return on investment is a no-brainer for some team. And the Cavs are definitely in a position where if he falls to them, they have to take him, because he will at that point be your best shot at getting another potential, you know, high-level contributor if they're able to get things to click for him and get his athleticism and his transition ability to bleed over into other aspects of his game in a way that they haven't for North Carolina. So I definitely think, you know, if the slipping thing is real and he is falling to, like, the mid-20s, that's a coup for the Cavs.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be back to get into two more prospects that you should know at this position in the draft. So stay tuned for more of this episode of Locked On Cavs with myself and Trevor Magnotti. And we are back. Okay, Trevor, let's next get into Grant Williams, who I know you particularly like. Where is he on your draft board, and what should people know about what he provides?
So I am at 15th. He is a very, very good two-way player, one of the smartest players in the class. Makes fantastic reads on the defensive end, and is a very good passer on the offensive end as well. Sees the court very well, has very good touch, and very good touch on his finishes as well. I think that he's going to be kind of like a fully weaponized Jay Crowder in the league, where he's a little bit undersized but can play the full-time four because he has a ton of strength. And I think that his finishing ability is going to be his primary function on offense, with a little bit of elbow creation, a little bit of shooting on the perimeter, but really kind of like at average level at both. But the defensive value is going to be the big thing. A guy that can switch onto fives, can depend on the perimeter. He can basically handle whatever you need him to do. He's one of the best shot blocking players at his height that I've seen in the last few years. And just to be as active as he is at the rim at 6'5 is a really good sign for him moving forward, especially when you couple it with his instincts. So you're drafting him because you're looking for a guy who kind of fills the Nwaba role with some offensive upside, with his finishing, and also with the potential that he is going to be a better defender than Nwaba because he offers that little bit of rim protection ability and is a more instinctual team defender.
What are the knocks on him? You're clearly very high on him. So if you were to say, hey, here's one or two things that are concerning about him as a prospect, what are they?
I don't know that the passing is functional for an NBA offense. I mean, he is really good at creating on the elbow. That's his primary function. He's really good on kind of like driving kick stuff. But I don't know that that's actually going to be useful at the NBA level, because he's not going to be doing that stuff full time. And I also don't know if the shooting's real, which is obviously a problem. That's what crippled Crowder as a player with the Cavs, especially, was he couldn't knock down the open shots that he was getting in the offense. And that really seemed to affect him and his overall level play. you know, there's also the fact that he's, you know, 6'5 and plays the floor full time, and everybody gets a little weird about that, although we're getting better at recognizing, like, when that isn't a problem and when that is a problem in terms of how guys translate. I don't think it's going to be a problem for Williams in a way that it was for, like, Anthony Bennett, for example. Just the fact that him being undersized and also too slow to defend threes, Williams doesn't have the same issue. I just think that the issues I think with Williams are that if some team takes him like 12th, I think they're going to be a little bit disappointed because he probably isn't ever going to live up to the high end upside of his offensive ability. But if you're drafting him anywhere outside of the lottery, I mean, you've got a pretty safe rotation player with him, I think.
Well, how would he look? Let's say they take RJ Barrett at 2. How does like a wing rotation of Barrett, Williams, and Jetty look to you going forward?
I think that looks great because, I mean, you've got lineup versatility with all of those guys. I mean, you can play those three together with Kevin Love and Tristan Thompson and have a functional offense, I think, because you've got Williams to potentially, you know, kind of offer cutting and kind of accessory passing. Barrett can be a primary creator and you can go big with him as a point guard, and I think that that works a little bit better. Even though he's not a great passer, you've got Osman and Williams and Love to supplement him. You don't have to rely on Barrett as your primary facilitator. And then you can also go small with that group. I mean, you can throw Jetty at the 4. You can throw Williams potentially at the 5, ideally. You can play Barrett at the 3, and you can go with 2 guards in addition to them. I mean, the lineup versatility you would get with that pairing, in addition to who the Cavs have, is really exciting.
All right, next we're going to talk about Brandon Clark from Gonzaga. He's 6'8", 215 from Arizona. What's the lowdown on him, Trevor? Where's he at on your big board?
I've got him 13th, so slightly ahead of Williams. Very similar player to Williams, except instead of being, you know, a little shorter and a little bit thicker, Williams is kind of longer, lengthier, and a little bit springier as an athlete. He is probably the best shot blocker in this class, especially when you factor in his height disadvantage. I mean, he is Gonzaga's defense, and he is one of the best at meeting guys at the rim, has very good technique, doesn't foul, uses verticality very well, is really great at defending from the perimeter, guarding a drive all the way through, and finishing with a block. One of the things that you need a guy who's defending in space and switching onto guards to be able to do. And he couples that with, again, very good finishing. He's not a great passer, but does kind of the little accessory passing stuff that you want to see, and also has a little bit of a developing jumper in the same way that Williams does. Clark's jumper when he started at San Jose State was, outside of Caleb Martin of Nevada, probably the worst jumper that I've ever seen. And now, a few years later, he has a very functional jump shot that I think can continue to improve. He has made significant work and has totally reworked it much in the way that Kawhi Leonard did. And I think that he's got some latent upside, even though he is an older prospect, because that jumper is making positive steps and we can see it in what he's done in the college level. So I think that you're banking on with him being a guy that you can play as a full-time, like, 4 and small ball 5 that can protect the rim, and a guy who offers some mid-post scoring ability, potentially a spot-up jumper, and just some kind of team facilitation of offensive sets from, like, the 4 or 5 spot.
What are his weaknesses as a prospect?
Well, as just finished saying, I mean, he's kind of an outlier in that he's 22 and didn't shoot until this year. So we still need to see that his shooting is real. Because if it's not, then he doesn't have the same level of upside. And he's a okay rim protector, or he's a okay to good rim protector at the NBA level. Obviously, probably never going to be elite because he's 6'8". And then a guy who doesn't really have the greatest frame for you potentially asking him to do that. So I think that he needs to put on a little bit more strength. I think that the jumper continues to need work. He needs to improve kind of his confidence as a mid-post scorer and driver. And I think that if those things come together, he's definitely a lottery-level talent. If they don't, then you know, he's kind of just like a sixth or seventh man that is like your backup power forward that can occasionally switch to the five, which is a good player and can be valuable, but definitely would put a damper on taking him.
Okay, so two last things here as we wrap up. Number one, if the Cavs could pick, which doesn't seem likely, but if they could pick from all three of these guys, how would you rank them?
I would probably take... In terms of the Cavs fit, I would probably take Little first, Williams second, and Clark third. I just think that Clark is going to struggle to find playing time amongst the Cavs bigs because he's probably going to need to play the five a little bit to be effective. I think that Williams offers you a little bit more versatility because he can play the three. But I think that Whittle, you're just kind of betting on the upside play, and I would rather take that in this draft. Even especially if they are taking, like, ideally, if you're taking Whittle, you've also taken Jarrett Culver or Zion Williamson. You have a guy that you can bank on being a rotation player out of this draft regardless, and you're kind of taking a home run swing at that point. So it kind of depends on who you take first for who I would rank first between Williams and Whittle. I think if you need a safer option, you take Williams. If you need a, if you can afford a home run swing, you take Whittle. And that, and if both are gone, and Clark is still there, then Clark's a great option too.
So there seems like a scenario where the Cavs will not be able to pick any of these guys. Like that, depending on where the Rockets pick falls, like these guys could all be off the board. Is this type of player still an option if those guys are off the board, or should they be looking for something else? Like, obviously, we're not going to know this exact answer until draft night, but is, like, this the ideal group of guys that would fall to them with that second first-round pick? And if that is the case, what else – is there other options for them?
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a couple other guys who could make a lot of sense in this same position. I mean, I would look – more towards a wing if, like, these three guys in particular are gone. But, I mean, Demboya should still be there, I would think, unless somebody, like, falls in love with him. There are going to be other guys who I think fill that role who will be in that range. I like Dean Wade. I just wish he could stay healthy from Kansas State. I think that he's probably the best shooter of anybody that we've talked about as kind of like a pick-and-pop four. But obviously, he has stress-related injuries in his legs, and I would avoid that. A guy who has kind of been driving up my board since the last one I released, because I kind of finally got chances to watch him, is Chuma Okeke of Auburn. He's a guy who has risen up into the end of the first round a little bit, and he kind of offers some of the same skill set, is a decent shooter, very good defensive player, and can switch across multiple positions, so I like him. I've seen Eric Paschal of Villanova mocked to the Cavs recently. I think The Athletic had that. I don't hate that, because I think that he's like a legitimate three-point shooter and does have some defensive ability. I just don't think I'd be as high on him as other guys. So there are going to be still guys that they could take, but you know, I think if those big names are all gone, then maybe I start looking more towards like a pure wing, like a Nikhil Alexander Walker, like a Matisse Thybulle, like a Ignas Brazdeikis, those type of guys. Because if the fours are gone, the threes are probably still there, I would imagine.
You can find Trevor on Twitter at Illegal Screens. Find his Thick Jacked Frames podcast, excellent show, a Jarrett Culver episode, and a big NCAA tournament breakdown on that show this week. And you can find his writing at Fear the Sword and the Step Back. Trevor, as always, thank you so much.
Yep, thanks for having me.
And I'm just glad we got you in before you explode when the Ja Morant hive just explodes, when they, like, make a Cinderella run that you're not going to be excited for. I just want to say that I'm glad I got to talk to you again before, like, you just die because of that.
Oh, I think they're going to lose to Marquette.
Here's hoping. But that's going to be it for this week's show, and thanks everyone for listening. Cheers.